I'm wondering if you could tell me some of the other differences between the two types of radars in terms of ranges. Is Doppler far superior to the other system?
Yeah. Now, the other system, just to make sure that we have a good appreciation of the basic nature of operation, the so-called inertial navigation system operates and relies on an entirely different principle. It operates on the principle that if you have a platform which stands still, you have no accelerations. If you integrate acceleration over time, you get velocity out of that. If you integrate velocity over the time, you get position. The moment you start moving, there is acceleration. That's a fundamental fact of physics. So therefore, if you can measure the acceleration very carefully, you can also obtain velocity out of that, and you can also obtain position out of that, or distance, because acceleration of a certain period of time, etc., through velocity gives you that particular ultimate entity which you want to know, the distance over which I have moved. The two systems are completely different in nature because one measures the actual frequency, the other measures acceleration. One system is active to the extent you have to transmit a signal, radar, whether it be Doppler or any other radar, transmits energy, which is then bounced off. Inertial navigation is a passive system. It does not transmit anything. It just measures acceleration, which is simply due to the fact that you are moving through space. The two systems are complementary. So today, for example, in a typical passenger aircraft, 747 has both. They have two different characteristics. One gives you very good instantaneous and accurate readout of acceleration, speed, and distance. That's the Doppler radar. The other one gives you a very, very good long-term acceleration, velocity, and distance. If you combine the two, you get the best of the two worlds. Obviously, you cannot use Doppler radar type navigation sensor in areas where you do not have some surface to bounce it off. So, for example, if you look at all the space probes and space vehicles, etc., they rely exclusively on navigation because, you know, you don't need anything to bounce your energy off.
Now, is either one of these systems more prone to weather-related problems?
Yes, because Doppler radar, as any other radar, relies on an energy which is transmitted through the medium of, in this case, air, because there is always noise present, you to some extent rely on the nature of the surface. Let me put it this way. Let's say that you have an absolutely mirror-smooth sea surface. Doppler radar signal gets very weak because the original signal is, for a number of reasons, is not sent directly down, at which time, of course, it would reflect perfectly. Just think of it as a mirror.
Right.
But is, in fact, sent at an angle, and I don't remember now, it is 20 degrees or some similar figure. Now, you can imagine, take a flashlight and take a mirror. And if you point the flashlight at a mirror at about 20 degrees, you will get zero reflection back. Okay? On the other hand, if you have small waves and surface irregularities, there is at least some portion of the surface which is at right angles to your beam, at which time you get back the reflection, shifted in frequency if you move. So you can imagine that theoretically you could get from a situation of zero signal if the surface of the water is absolutely smooth to fairly large signal, 100% if you have got, you know, big waves, which gives you a nice big front. Now, in practice, at low altitudes, you certainly get some signal back even from the smoothest sea surface due to scattering effects, but I don't want to go into the technical aspects. And similarly, when you have big waves and so on and so forth, you perhaps have too much signal and you have interfering signals where there is, in fact, less accuracy that you could get otherwise. But this is compensated for by signal processing.
Now, both of these radar systems were particularly important from...
Well, we are talking about radar system and inertial navigation, okay?
Right.
Because I want to make sure that One is a radar system in a true sense. Mm-hmm. The other one is inertial navigator, which is not a radar system. It does not transmit energy.
Right, okay. But using these two complementary systems and having that outfitted in the Sea King helicopter was particularly important from a navigational perspective for the pilot operating under extremely difficult conditions in say the North Atlantic in dead of winter when they are 3-4 hours out from the ship conducting ASW exercises or using their dunking sonar. And so this was a particularly important development, I assume.
Now, it was. One, again, small addition to make sure that whoever listens to that in the future will appreciate the elegance but also critical differences between the two. In a helicopter system, we never used inertial sensor for navigation purposes. What we did have is an inertial sensor in the form of orthogonal gyros, which is three gyroscopes mounted on three mutually perpendicular axes, which gave us the appropriate signals, which were then manipulated through the electronics, my favorite area of interest, which were used for attitude control and autopilot control to make sure helicopter is stable. Mm-hmm. So we never used the inertial sensor in a helicopter for navigation. We used it for stabilization. Doppler radar, on the other hand, was used exclusively for navigation.
All right. Now, you've raised an interesting point here. Perhaps you could tell us about the important role that you played personally in VX-10 on the autopilot for the Sea King helicopters. I know that the Royal Aircraft Establishment in Farnborough was the first, I think, to develop an autopilot for helicopters specifically. But this system was certainly improved upon, and the Canadian Navy had a very large role to play in that, and perhaps you can elaborate.
Okay. Just to make sure that, again, we have a good appreciation of the nature of the process. Contrary to what you would find in a fixed-wing aircraft, helicopter is fundamentally an unstable entity, an unstable machine. In other words, if you took your hands off the collective and throttle sticks, you would find out that the helicopter would very rapidly fall off the skies, literally. So therefore, in order to give the helicopter a virtual stability, I'm borrowing the words from modern technology, similar to that of fixed-wing aircraft, helicopter autopilot is absolutely essential entity, and that's normally what you would fly. You would actually fly an autopilot. Now, Sikorsky aircraft, such as others, Karman, for example, which we are also looking at the time, and Bell, they all have autopilots. However, what none of them had was a system which would use inputs from altitude sensors. In our case, it was radar altimeter, and so on and so forth. Velocity sensors, in our case, Doppler radar, and measure where you are in terms of speed and attitude, allow itself to be programmed to reach a condition, ultimate desirable point, where you want to be stationary at 50 feet over ocean surface, so that you can actually dunk your sonar ball and do the things which sonars do, and do it in a reliable fashion under all conditions of weather and so on and so forth. This is what we, in fact, helped to develop, install, and prove. And that was probably one of the most intensive and time-consuming exercises which we had, to the extent that I remember we would go day after day after day and take meters and meters of recordings of aircraft going through that transition. That is probably the most dangerous phase of aircraft operations. You have heard about the dead zone, have you?
No.
Okay. Well, what basically happens is this. Helicopters don't glide very well.
Have a tendency to drop like a rock.
Yes, unfortunately. Now, if you are, for the sake of argument, at 50 feet in a helicopter and you lose an engine, you can probably get it down to the surface and land without major damage. I mean, you will have a bit of a shock when it comes down, but over a distance of 50 feet, it's generally accepted. Okay, you can recover from that. You might damage a few things, but you will still recover. If you are flying at 200 feet and over in a forward flight mode, due to the forward flight motion of the helicopter and the fact that your rotor spins and so on and so forth, you can do an auto-rotation. In fact, I remember intentionally causing an engine failure, not in the sitting, but in a Bell helicopter which we had, and literally auto-rotating from 1,000, 1,500 feet down to the deck. That's okay. When you are, however, in this belt of, let's say, around 100 feet, plus or minus a bit, you are in a so-called dead man's zone. You are too high to land down on the surface of the water without major damage, usually fatal damage, and you are too low to auto-rotate successfully. So you are trying to avoid that area at all costs. And this is why this automatic transition from forward flight to hover was so crucial to the concept of all-weather operations. Because at night, you do not have the visual cues and perceptions. Everything looks black.
Right.
So you don't really know. Of course, altimeter will tell you you are at, you know, 100 feet or 200 feet, but automatically, you don't have the quick responses and reliable responses of the human to compensate for funny things. If you can have a automatic flight control system which takes all the information and instantly compensates before it becomes dangerous and programs you to go from a forward flight to hover, you have got something. And this is what we developed, and this is what we proved, and this is ultimately what we, in fact, achieved.
So when you, just to put this in context then, the role that you played personally on working on the single sideband, high frequency, that's an important component of this whole concept. Likewise, so is Doppler radar. But the autopilot, to take it from forward flight down into hover, is particularly important in making this entire concept work.
Because it's directly related to flight safety.
And so the engineers will argue that the bear trap system is a key component of what is now known as RAST. You could argue that this is particularly important because without this system, there would not have been that all-weather capability, and it would have been a particularly dangerous operation and would have had to have been done manually if this system was not developed.
Yeah. Again, you know, to put things in proper perspective, one tends to take a particular pride in one's own little portion of the things. And one could indeed argue that if you didn't have that autopilot capability, you couldn't really carry out all-weather night operations. And if you couldn't carry out all-weather flight operations, we will have missed the raison d'etre for having that helicopter in the first place. But I think that would be a little presumptuous. I prefer to look at it in this fashion. Look at the helicopter as a total major weapon system. And similar to the human body, you know, which has kidneys, heart, liver, lungs, and hopefully brains to tie it all together, it's very difficult to argue which one is more important. I would sort of see it as a process. Okay, my specialty is liver, somebody else's specialty is kidneys. Can you really live comfortably without either? Which one is more important? I don't know.
Now, certainly this, when we talk about this particular system, it's not like VX-10 could go out there and conduct trials like they could with the single sideband VHF system, which does not endanger anyone's lives, doesn't endanger of what is at that time of a particularly expensive aircraft. VX-10 had one Sea King to start out to with some of their trials. How did VX-10 or what did VX-10 work out in terms of a process in order to start testing this auto system?
Okay, well, again, it's a very, very long and very tedious process. I'll try to make it as simple as I can. just like everything else in aeronautics world in which we're involved, you have the team of experts. You have the aeronautical engineer who is responsible for stresses, placement of things, cutting holes in the fuselage, which is normally not very desirable, just to make sure that it has mechanical integrity, so you have not endangered something by cutting holes when you shouldn't. Electrical engineer, which is me, I suppose, in this case, a responsibility for making sure that you have appropriate power feeding in, that you don't create electromagnetic interference, as it was known, popularly called even now, that you get the necessary inputs and outputs out of that. And again, in a typical experimental mode of operation, you start very carefully. First of all, you put it in on the ground. Then you gently put the power on and hopefully cross your fingers, nothing burns out and nothing explodes. And I mean, I know it sounds like a joke, but sometimes you get a perfectly good equipment from the manufacturer, something has gone wrong, maybe in transit, maybe elsewhere, you connect it, put the power on, and boom, it goes. Very embarrassing to both. Then, once you have done that, you carry out, and I'm skipping, you know, a heck of a lot of activity. Then you actually put it on, put other systems on the ground, in the hangar, without any power on the engines, and you see that all the signals are there and all the displays are there, and you don't have any indications that you have a disaster. Then, of course, you take it out of the hangar, turn the engines on, turn the fan on, as we call it, whether it be normal aircraft with propellers or this one with rotary wings. And again, you see what is happening. Is there interference? Will it actually play together? And when you are absolutely satisfied that everything seems to be okay, and of course usually there isn't, there is always something which happens, but it's more of a fun than a detriment. You gently go from phase to phase, first of all trying to prove the system works as a system in a safe mode, i.e. at much higher altitudes,
right,
just to make sure that, you know, if something, heavens forbid, happens, you can come down and auto-rotate on all stuff, and then you ultimately get down to lower altitudes. Then you start your trials from forward flight mode to transition during perfect weather, perfect visibility, and of course it's fully instrumented, so you have a record of what's going on and you measure certain things such as attitudes, velocities, altitude, etc. And hopefully when you push that button, the helicopter starts doing what it should be doing. And if in fact it seems to be okay, well, you continue until you are in hover and see what happened, and you judge, well, was it approximately right or not? Then, of course, after the mission, you analyze. If, for whatever reason, you punch that button, and instead of transitioning nicely from forward flight to hover, it begins to do funny things, or attempts to even do funny things, of course, you instantly disengage and then go back to normal mode. Then you go back home and say, okay, now what happened? And you have instrumentation and records, which tells you number of inputs which you need to examine, and you say, okay, well, why was that? Maybe one of the inputs were missing for whatever reason, or maybe one signal was of the wrong type, or wrong amplitude, or wrong frequency, or whatever.
So this is a very long and drawn-out process.
Oh, yes.
For not only safety reasons, but from an engineering and electrical perspective.
Oh, yes. It's unbelievable.
In order for this particular system, the autopilot, to take the aircraft from forward flight through the transition and into hover, how long do you remember this particular part of the project going on?
Oh, about a year and a half.
A year and a half.
Of course, it always goes on, but it took us about a year and a half. The most critical thing, as I remember, and that is a very interesting story. I don't know if we have time for it, do we?
We can start it today, and if we don't finish it, we can pick it up on the next tape.
Basically, we felt that we had a system working as a system. Sikorsky Aircraft, the builder of the helicopter, of course, did not entirely release it for service use, because they, as aircraft manufacturer, of course, want to be ultra-safe. Because we are using a brand new type of Doppler radar, which they have never seen before, and so on and so forth, they were not ready to release it for service use in that automatic transition from forward flight to hover. So we had a bit of a difficulty. They, in fact, suggested a $150,000 US in that order that I remember, test plan at their facility to satisfy themselves and prove that it's good and it's possible and it's safe. Now, today, of course, $150,000 isn't much in that sort of a game, but in those days it was huge. And, of course, we always had the pride of delivering on budget and on time. So to make long story short, one of the greatest challenges I personally had was, how do I prove to Sikorsky that we have an absolutely safe system? Their main point was that you are, in fact, introducing systems into the helicopter which weren't there before. You have got signals which weren't there before. And because those signals automatically, ultimately, feed the autopilot, autopilot creates mechanical motions which are transmitted to the rotor head, the single most critical item. Because if you lose your rotor head, you have got no fan, and therefore the helicopter turns into a stone. They were basing their claim on the fact that if you looked at the signal which was in the system as the result of our automatic transition because of the Doppler radar signal presence, it was introducing vibrations which were transmitted to the head. And they said, well, if you have vibrations in the head, it's not terribly good because you will have a failure. You know, take a paper clip. As soon as you start bending it a little, ultimately, if you bend it frequently enough, it will break.
Right.
Now, the question was, how do we prove it? And that's what they said, we'll need $150,000 to prove it. And again, I am speaking a hell of a lot of time and head scratching and soul scratching and brain scratching. But ultimately, and that's one of my pride and joy items, I said to myself, okay, I cannot fight Sikorsky because we don't have the resources, but I can probably give them an indisputable logical proof which their chief aeronautical engineer, I forget his last name, but it was Joe, very nice guy, cannot possibly refute. Because, you know, there is certain collegial trust, just like there is one between doctors, engineers, philosophers, or whatever. And I came with an idea, and I discussed it with Hank Isaac, my boss in headquarters, and he was absolutely fascinated. And he said, you really think you can do it? I said, we've got nothing to lose by trying. And my concept was this. Okay, I know that in nature you don't have clean things. You never have a clean system. If you turn on the radio, there's always a bit of static. Similarly, there must be signals and motions in the head, whether our radar is on or off. So with the help of my colleague Peter Charlton, in fact, we decided to put strain gauges. And strain gauges can be so put and glued to the rotor head that they'll give you a signal which is proportional to stress, and you can measure the stress. With the help of that, and again, I'm skipping a heck of a lot of events, we measured on tape the signals which were present in the rotor head when it was flying in a normal mode, which were there when you were manually transitioning from forward flight to hover, of course under daylight conditions and perfect conditions, and when you are in the hover. And then we did it with the automatic transition mode. And lo and behold, most fortunate for us, we found out that, in fact, when we put an automatic pilot mode, the signals and stresses which we measured in the main rotor heads not only did not increase, but in fact, they decreased from what they were before, which indicated to me that there was something beneficial damping of the signals going through.
Oh, I see.
Once that happened, I said, okay, I got it. And in great excitement, I called Hank Isaac and I explained to him. And he said, you know, Frank, we've got something. Well, let's go to Sikorsky and see what can be done. So with my boss in the squadron, Shell Rowell, my good friend, Peter and everybody else, we went there. And we had a major conference and we ensured that Joe, I wish I remembered his last name, called him Joe Stratford, you know, or Joe Sikorsky, was there. And with prior contact with them and full cooperation, they were fully aware of the fact of how we instrumented things, how we measured, so there was no question as to credibility of our data. And you know, they know it by now sufficiently well so that they will not say, well, are those really the signals which you measured, you know, and was your instrumentation there? That was already proven before. And ultimately, the issue was, can that represent a safe flight? And as a coup de grace, once we established good conversation, I sort of spoke to Joe, because he was representing the Sikorsky, and I said, Joe, can I make an assumption, which I would like to make, that you folks have built a safe aircraft? Well, of course we built a safe aircraft, you know, we wouldn't build any which wasn't safe. Oh, well, no, good, I just want to make sure that we start from square one. I said, therefore, can I make an assumption that whatever stresses you have in the heads, rot of head, are normal, tolerable, and not injurious to the safe operation of the aircraft? Well, of course, we have spent hundreds of thousands of hours testing it and all that stuff. I said, good. Now, here is tape of stresses in the heads which we measured. And he already knew how we did it, so there was no question, was our instrumentation correct? Which occurred during normal forward flight, hand transmission, and hover. Oh, yeah, we recognize that, yeah, that's perfectly normal. There's a bit of 400 cycle movement, because one of the main AC generators is 400 cycles. You could actually read it, which is very interesting. I said, okay, now Joe, I'll give you the tapes, and we have duplicates, so you can keep them. Here is a portion of the tape with normal stresses, and you will notice that at this point in time, we engaged the automatic pilot and affected a forward flight to hover mode. And you will notice how all the previous stresses and signals in the rotor head, in fact, were dumped, and you have less motion and less stresses than you had before. Well, to make long story short, his jaw dropped down. He couldn't dispute the scientific validity of it, so we had a nice conversation, said, well, of course, I'll have to discuss it with my masters, etc., but yes, that is a very, very interesting observation. To make long story short, Sikorsky could no longer claim that they cannot release it for service use. Because had they claimed that they cannot release it for service use on the basis of that documentation, what that would imply is that they have an unsafe helicopter at any time. Mm-hmm. Well, of course, no manufacturer will ever admit that. So very shortly after that, there was an agreement and they released the helicopter for service use in the automatic transition from forward flight to hover mode. Beautiful. Fun. That was fun. Hell of a lot of work, but fun.
Now I assume that you would have, and VX-10 would have had an oscillograph on board the
Sea King
in order to monitor the inputs from the sensors.
Yes, we had a complete instrumentation, which incidentally we sort of patterned and modeled after Naval Air Development Center in Johnsonville, Pennsylvania, which was the big U.S. Navy establishment with whom we had excellent rapport. And of course, as I mentioned to you before, prior to the tape being turned on, that I was fortunate enough to work with them at some time. So that, of course, was a very, very useful, standard, excellent measuring system with which they could not quarrel, because that's what the U.S. Navy used. So if they said, well, no, that's not valid, no good, then they didn't have fights on their hands with us. They had fight on their hands with U.S. Navy, and that is unthinkable. Yeah. Peter Charlton, of course, was, because it was mostly, you know, racks and instrumentation and this and that, he was the engineering officer responsible for the physical installation, so he gets the credit for putting that package in.
All right. Now, do you remember offhand how long it took you and the squadron to collect that data as it relates to the autopilot and the vibrations and...
We collected that data for all practical purposes during my entire period in VX-10, which was till 1965.
All right.
Something like that, I believe.
Okay? So almost 3 years.
That's right. Now, I have to clarify by saying we didn't need to wait 3 years to do it. In other words, from the time that we started doing it to the time that we had that critical point where we said, you have no choice, Mr. Sikorsky, but to release it for service use, that was only about, say, call it a year and a half.
All right.
But, you know, you don't stop there because you want to also gather certain data as to repeatability and reliability. Now, as you want to ensure that it doesn't happen just once, but
right.
It happens normally.
So that would have...
That would go on a number of trials
in order to determine that. So
yes.
You would have sort of what you could consider a norm and then sort of a deviation in order to...
Addition.
All right. Okay. I wasn't sure terminology, but...
Sure.
To make sure that it was consistent throughout the entire period that you were conducting these trials, so that you had some point of accurate reference.
Yeah. Well, this is really similar to, let's say, statistical processes. When you want to put something, you say, well, the minimum sample you have to have is about 30, because anything less 30, statisticians will consider inadequate to develop and discover a trend. But of course, you don't stop at 30, you go on and on. And of course, your data gets better and better and better, and you get higher probability that what you have is representative of what happens, as opposed to, well, it's a guess.
Right. Okay. Well, I think we'll have to stop here today, and we will pick it up when you get back from your trip to Ottawa.
My pleasure.